You're listening to episode 5 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is episode 5 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. I know, just said that, didn't I? But yeah, my name's Klaatu. This is the GNU World Order. It's a technical podcast, Ogcast. We release in Og Vorbis and Speaks formats. Those are both free audio formats. And by free, I mean they are something that people can use and even modify the source code of and redistribute, all without concerns of being sued or paying licensing fees or anything like that. The show is about Linux, GNU, Unix, lots of technical topics. If this is your first time listening, welcome. If not, also welcome. In this episode, we're going to talk about just kind of random stuff that comes to mind. First, of course, we will take listener feedback. We'll also take a moment to discuss a couple of new releases that I wanted to talk about. The Trinity Desktop Environment, Steam and Valve, and lots of other topics. So let's get started. Okay, first let's talk about listener feedback, because that's how we do it here. So I think the farthest back listener feedback I've got right here is from my friend Mordency, who I met quite some time now ago at Ohio Linux Fest. And this year, he and I and the Verbals from Chicago, Mr. and Mrs. Verbal from Chicago, and Mordency's brother, whose name is simply escaping me right now, which makes me feel just horrible. We hung out and went out to this Persian restaurant. Was it Persian? It was a restaurant, and they had really, really good kebabs. I'm a sucker for grilled vegetables, and so going there and having this fantastic vegetable kebab and some really, really good tea. I think it was cardamom tea, maybe. I'm not sure. But it was just, I mean, everything was fantastic. It was a lot of fun, and it was really kind of a neat experience to get taken way outside of the kind of that sort of, you know, 3-mile radius that you're usually in during the Ohio Linux Conference, to be able to actually go to some other place in Ohio. That was kind of fun to experience some of the city or some of the area around the actual conference itself. So that was really cool, but has nothing to do with his email. His email was something he was talking to me and Murph about. There are two things. There was some SSH stuff. There's the SSH talk that he saw. The slides are online. You can go to carltm.com/sshtalk-olf.odp. So that's the slides for this talk on SSH, which was supposed to be a very good talk. So you can check that out at that link. The link will be in the show notes. There's also some really cool and interesting stuff about some scripts that Mordency has been writing, some Linux-centric scripts, and you can find that at github.com/mordency/my_linux_scripts. So that's github.com/mordency, mordancy/my_linux_scripts. So check some of those scripts out. They're really quite interesting to look at, and depending on your workflow, could be quite useful to you. So that was from Mordency. So thanks a lot for that. Let's see. There was something from Deep Geek, and actually something first from Alan. Alan emailed me. This isn't the Alan at Tilts. This is a different Alan. And he emailed me to thank me for the Fat Chance Lester albums, which I'm glad some people enjoy those. It's always good to hear some feedback about some of that weird stuff that I keep putting onto the internet. So, finally, from Deep Geek, we got a question from him. Deep Geek, you'll know from Talk Geek to Me, or I guess formerly Talk Geek to Me, and Hacker Public Radio. So, Deep Geek asked a question about SE Linux specifically, and he said that in light of all the recent NSA and Prism and all those kinds of wonderful, I want to say disclosures, but they weren't exactly disclosures, were they? Leaks, I guess? I don't know. That's kind of a buzzword now. Everything is leaked now. You know, everything on the internet is a leak now. That's just the new term for, you know, stuff you found online. But yeah, I mean, whatever. The fact that everyone now knows that the NSA has, surprise, surprise, been spying on people, which, I mean, to me, a little bit of a side note here, I mean, how many of us didn't already know that? I mean, I realize that there was not really an official admission or anything like that, but I mean, I don't know of that many Linux users, certainly in the, at least in the circles that I'm finding myself in, who wouldn't have said that already anyway. So the fact that people are finally hearing that the NSA is spying on computer users, it's just, it's one of those, no, really moments. You're just like, yeah, of course they are. So I don't see how that's really at all surprising to anyone, but maybe it is to some people, and certainly to the mainstream computer user, I guess maybe it is. Although I suspect that, like everything else, mainstream computer users don't probably really care all that much anyway. Okay, that aside, the NSA, of course, developed SE Linux, Security Enhanced Linux. It's a kernel, sort of kernel-level code to ensure that certain processes cannot run in ways that those processes should not run, that makes no sense for those processes to run. And DeepGeek's question was whether I'd heard anything in the Fedora or Red Hat forums or mailing lists or that community, since he knows that I'm a little bit of a part of that community. Had I heard anything about that? And whether they wanted to do like a big code review or anything like that. And I mean, I know that very recently TrueCrypt got funded on Kickstarter to, or rather, a code review of TrueCrypt got funded on Kickstarter, because apparently, according to the Kickstarter, this sounds bizarre to me, but no one knows who made TrueCrypt. The code is there, it exists, but no one knows who wrote it. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever, but okay, whatever. So they wanted to do a full code review of TrueCrypt because people have been using it to encrypt things, and they want to make sure it's truly, truly secure. So that a full code review is going to be done now on TrueCrypt. I don't really use TrueCrypt myself. I have LVM and Lux for that, which I did an episode on, or a segment in an episode on. Just look back in the show archives, and you will find a very good review of that process. So I've been using that. Haven't really been using TrueCrypt. I don't really use SE Linux all that much either, in my personal life, but it does exist on some of the servers that I run for professional life. And my impression had always been that SE Linux certainly hadn't just been suddenly dumped on someone's doorstep and just, like a Linux kernel developer woke up in the morning, saw SE Linux disks on his doorstep and plugged it into his computer and loaded the code into the kernel and committed. I mean, I always gathered that it was something that the kernel devs kind of looked at, experimented with, tried out, analyzed, and then integrated and merged into the kernel. And Linus Torvalds, of course, gave sort of an ambiguous answer when someone asked, had the government ever approached him about putting a backdoor into the Linux kernel? He vocally said no while nodding his head. So the nodding of his head, at least here in the US, usually means yes, so he said no. So two conflicting answers. I'm assuming that was a clever way of saying yes. But I don't really know what that means. But I mean, the kernel developers are not just one person, they are many people. There are many different people in different projects looking at the SE Linux code, so I'm assuming that it's all been sort of code reviewed already and analyzed and made sure that there wasn't a backdoor. I mean, I'm assuming also that backdoors are usually very cleverly implemented. I'm assuming there's not just like a code module like SE Linux dot backdoor paren paren. I mean, it's probably not that obvious. So I don't know what a code review. I don't know that a code review. Do you have to do a code review to look for a backdoor, or do you just do a code review and then notice a backdoor? I do not know. My assumption has always been that it has been reviewed and audited already. And that is certainly my assumption after doing research in order to answer DeepGeek intelligently. I could not find on any mailing list or any forum or anything like that online in the Fedora or the Red Hat communities that were really, voicing really any concern over SE Linux at all. It my impression was and is that the NSA developed the code, and then that the open source community has basically taken it and run with it. And so the bulk of the development has not been done by the NSA. So if there's a backdoor, it would have had to been in that initial kind of like implementation. And I'm assuming that when people started working on the thing, they probably checked for that sort of thing. Because, I mean, after all, who actually trusts the NSA anyway? That's my impression. Obviously, I don't know. I've not reviewed the code myself. I can't tell you that SE Linux is completely safe and trustworthy. I mean, I just have no clue. But that's certainly my impression, and that's kind of like that's what I had before and after my research. DeepGeek also, on a sort of a side note, mentions that the Happenstance album that I just released for Fat Chance Lester will not play on Rockbox. I've had the same issue myself, actually. I thought it was just me and the way that I'd loaded it onto my Rockbox device, but it sounds like it might not be just me, so I'm going to look at that and try to fix that soonish. Okay, final listener feedback is really, really cool. It's about QML. QML, it was kind of a... I started hearing about it maybe 2 years ago, possibly earlier, but QML was, at the time, I got the impression it was a plasmoid kind of specific mini language for KDE, so you could be a KDE developer and you want to whip up a quick, I don't know, weather widget. So you could do this, presumably, with QML. So QML was kind of a Qt-based mini language, and actually I think it does stand for Qt Meta Language or something like that, or I could be wrong about that. I could be making that up. There's a Wikipedia page on it somewhere that I'm not looking at right now. But it's a small JavaScript-based language that is supposed to help web developers be able to use the stuff that they already know, like JavaScript, HTML, CSS. They should be able to use that to tap into the Qt framework and produce GUI applications for instance, KDE. Or Qt, Razor, Qt, whatever. So that's the idea behind QML, from what I'm understanding. And or certainly that's the drive behind it. And I remember there were a couple of Google Summer of Codes things that were working a lot with QML. So, I mean, it's been kind of developed over the past couple of years. And now there's a really, really great series on it on YouTube. And it's quite a good series. One of the problems that I have frequently with online tutorials at all are that they'll come out and they'll be very kind of piecemeal. You know, someone will do an episode on some thing that you need to learn, and then they'll stop midway through, and the next one that sort of comes up in the list will be something that's vaguely related, but it skips over a big important chunk, so then you have to watch another episode of someone else's tutorial to try to piece that stuff together. You know, it's very frequently not very cohesive. That's the word I'm looking for. It's not cohesive. So, if you go to goo.gl/CB4, that's Charlie Beta and the number 4, AFP, that's Alpha Foxtrot Papa. If you go to that shortened URL, that's goo.gl/CharlieBeta4AlphaFoxtrotPapa, you will find yourself at a YouTube page that has a full series on QML, from really installing the IDE, a quick tour of the IDE, and what to do once you're, you know, you've got the IDE figured out, and it's Qt Creator, so spoiler, if you already know Qt Creator, then you can skip practically maybe the first 5 episodes, or at least skim through them. And then from episode 6 or so on, it's a great tutorial on leveraging QML. It's really, really cool. It breaks it down really well. The guy does just a fantastic job. It's one of the better tutorials that I've seen. It's free. And the screencast is on Ubuntu, which is always nice. Really no complaints about it whatsoever. I was very impressed. And you should take a look at it if you're at all interested in QML, or even if you never heard of QML but you are interested in GUI programming, this looks like a really interesting way to get started. I mean, the other option, I guess, would be PyQt, which is a fantastic little framework as well. And I've been kind of thinking about doing maybe an episode or two about that just for kicks. But QML is certainly something to look at if you're not already invested, say, in Python. If you know a little bit about web languages and want to do a desktop GUI application, QML is kind of it's a really, really cool and promising little language to get to know. Okay, vaguely related to QML, if we really stretch our relational definitions, is the Trinity desktop environment. So what is the Trinity desktop environment? Well, if you go to trinitydesktop.org, then you could learn a lot about it, but I'll give you the brief rundown. Around the time that KDE 4.0 came out, people started freaking out. They hated KDE 4, and they wanted everything to always be the same as KDE 3.5. What was it then? Maybe 8 or so? Maybe 5? I don't know. 3.5 point something. They liked that paradigm. They didn't want it to change. KDE 4 changed a lot of stuff. So what do you do in open source and free software when something changes out from under you? You fork the project, and that's exactly what Trinity Desktop Environment is. It is the KDE Desktop 3.5 branch forked into eternity. And Trinity, I'm assuming, is referencing the 3 series. So Trinity Desktop Environment 3.5. I guess the latest official 3.5 release, if my memory is serving, was 12. 3.5.12. It could have been 3.5.10, I guess, but whatever. It's that latest branch, or that latest release, forked and maintained so that as the lower level libraries start to change and as Qt itself evolves, the 3.5 look and feel and behavior is preserved. So right when it came out, I didn't really have any reason to check out Trinity Desktop. I mean, it was forked. It was exactly what everyone was leaving behind, so why bother looking at it? It's the same as it ever was. So later, I started getting kind of curious about it, and I would kind of check in periodically, but it just didn't seem like a whole lot was happening with it. And now, many, many years later, now that we're in, 4.10.5, well, that's what I'm running anyway, in KDE, I started to wonder what was going on with Trinity. So I decided to check it out. So a couple of disclaimers first. First of all, I was never a KDE 3.5 guy, really. I mean, I was, I guess, in so far as I'd used it, but I wasn't married to KDE 3.5. Certainly not the way that I'm married to KDE 4.x right now. 4.x, I'm pretty well invested in. I've got a lot of computers running KDE 4.10.5 currently. I know it really well. I know exactly what it can do. I know what its weaknesses are. KMail. it's something that I'm familiar with and that I like a lot. And that's kind of when I jumped on board the KDE bandwagon, really, was at the 4.x series. So I was never, it wasn't like I was leaving 3.5. I was never with 3.5. Slackware obviously shipped with 3.5 for a very long time, or the 3 series for a very long time. So it was there, but I honestly usually opted for Fluxbox over 3.5. Now, I did use 3.5 a lot because, first of all, I had a bootable Slacks drive. I had, I think, a bootable Kubuntu drive at the time. I had a laptop from a company that I was working for. It was not a Linux laptop, but it was another operating system, Unix-based, and I installed KDE 3.5 on that, which I don't even remember how I did that. And I remember quite well, though, that I had the laptop on my desk plugged into an external monitor, and on the laptop screen was the native environment for that computer, and on the external monitor was KDE 3.5. And it was a really great way to be able to work in this abhorrent proprietary environment and also be able to use the free software tools that I loved. So I had a minor special place in my heart for Trinity, but nothing emotional. It was just kind of, it was working, not Trinity, 3.5. Nothing emotional. It was just something that I used. Okay, so when I finally did try the Trinity desktop environment, and I'm saying finally, like in the past 2 weeks, I went to trinitydesktop.org/wiki/bin/view/documentation/fedora-binary-installation. And that's how I installed it. It's an easy install. It's like two or three commands that you can copy and paste into a terminal. It's very simple. It's just adding a repository, updating it, adding a GPG key, I think, and then installing all of the different components. It's a big download, so it's not quick, but it's easy. Once it is finished, you can log out of GNOME or whatever desktop you're running on your Fedora computer, or Debian or whatever. I mean, they've got packages for lots of different things. It just so happens that my test box is running Fedora right now. So once you do that, you log out of your desktop, log back into TDE, Trinity Desktop Environment. And the first thing that you'll see, if you've ever used the 3.5 series of KDE, will be very familiar. It is the old familiar first launch setup wizard thing, and that asks you things like, how do you want your desktop to behave? Do you want it to be like a Mac, or like Windows, or like Unix, or what? And so that kind of governs whether you're going to single click or double click to open icons. It helps you decide whether you want lots of desktop effects or just a few, how powerful your CPU and GPU are, different little setup tasks like that. It's about, I don't know, six or seven different, the theme. It asks you about the widget theme. I'd say it was about six or seven screens. Click through those, and then you're dumped into the desktop. And what can I say? The Trinity desktop environment is exactly what it claims to be. It is KDE 3.5 series preserved in time, frozen. It is exactly as we left it. I was, I guess, in some weird way, I was almost expecting something more, like something new and maybe quote unquote exciting, but it is exactly what it. I mean, it was forked because they wanted 3.5 to stick around. And so looking back at it now, 3 or 4 years later, whatever, it is still 3.5. So, I mean, that's success, right? I mean, that's exactly what they claimed that they were going to do. So the fact that I could load it onto my Fedora box and run it now in without any kind of problems of like, oh, you don't have this library, or I don't know what this environment variable means anymore, it all works now. So, I mean, if you're really, really into 3.5, then you're gonna love Trinity Desktop, and I highly recommend it to you if you are. Conqueror is the same old Conqueror. I was never, again, I was never really a Conqueror guy because it felt, to me at least, like by the time 4.0 came out, they were really kind of getting away from Conqueror as a thing. They weren't really, that wasn't exactly the, they were kind of, they were moving on to like, okay, we're going to have a separate file manager, we're going to have a separate web browser. Things started actually being modularized a lot more than I think certainly a Conqueror had ever been. I mean, the Conqueror was kind of like everything about KDE crammed into one application. So that the classic Conqueror exists in Trinity. If you loved that, if that was your app, that's where it is right now, Trinity. It's not the new Conqueror, it's the old Conqueror with all the little tabs down the side and all the buttons. It's exactly how you left it. So there's that. The classic application start menu is there. The classic look and feel of 3.5 series is there in Trinity. So if you've missed it and you want to go back to 3.5, I don't see why you wouldn't run Trinity Desktop Environment. It seems stable. I mean, I shouldn't say that. For 2 weeks, as I ran it on every, just every now and again, not doing a whole lot of serious work, it seemed stable. I don't know what that means, because I'm basically just messing around with it. I'm not really using it. But, I mean, it would stand to reason that it would be stable. I mean, it is a pretty stable code base, just perpetuated. So, I mean, it's there to use. It's exactly as you left it, and it works. And to me, I mean, I don't mean to sound totally unexcited about it, but I kind of am. I mean, it really is not an exciting thing. It's actually, it is by nature an unexciting thing. It is 3.5 perpetuated. It's nothing new. It's not progressive. It's not exciting. It's not different. It's not daring. It is old and still usable. And that, as unexciting as that sounds, and as unexciting as that is, it's actually really, really cool and important. Because I think one of the big things about free and open source software is that you don't abandon your users. Now, sometimes that's a big deal, like, oh, we have important data, and if you change something, then we won't be able to access that data. That's a big deal, and that's important, and that's like one of those really sort of penultimate kind of commandments that you really should never break, and which proprietary software vendors break all the time. They deprecate file formats and data formats and everything all the time. It's happened quite famously very, very recently. I'm not going to get into it. Just trust me. I'm in a world where that is happening. So the fact that open source free software does not do that is very important to me. And then on the lower, on the lesser important thing, is just kind of like the modern conveniences. Like, gee, I really like this Conqueror application. I like how my desktop is laid out. I like how it looks. I like that I know where all my preferences are and how to change everything. That's important. I mean, it wouldn't honestly, you know, prevent people from getting their work done. It might slow them down for a week or two while they get up to speed on the new desktop or whatever. But if you take a desktop away from someone, they're still going to be able to do their work. They can adapt. And we know this. I mean, it is possible. It's happened before, both in proprietary and obviously in open source. I mean, famously with KDE, famously again with GNOME. It's something that's happening. But the fact that in open source and free software you can keep that old stuff anyway, that's really important. And it's not a deal breaker, I think, if you couldn't do that, but you can, and that's cool and that's important. GNOME changed over to 3.0, people forked GNOME too, and now you have things like Cinnamon and Mate and all these other things that I don't quite understand. And then there's KDE, Trinity and KDE 4.0. So that's fantastic, and that's important to me, and I think that in terms of making users happy, that's an edge that open source and free software has that other software vendors simply will not implement. It's not that they cannot have it, it's just that they happen to not care to implement it. They don't give users that kind of flexibility, and that's one of those reasons that open source free software is kind of nice. And that's an advantage I think we should strive to maintain. So if you're into Trinity, 3.5, Trinity is the place to go. You should support it and champion it and be excited about it. Me, I'm not, but you should be. Speaking of old things that never change, Slackware 14.1 is out. It has been out for maybe, I don't know, 4 days? 5 days now? It's really exciting. Me and the all other Slackware users have been kind of looking forward to it. We've been teased for almost a month, I think, with release candidates and bug fixes and things like that. Maybe more than a month, actually. It's been a while. Looking over the change log, you'll always see these things come in, it's a release candidate. We're really getting really close, and then there's a bunch of bug fixes, and it's like, okay, now we're really close, and then there's another bunch of bug fixes. So, but yeah, finally it happened. 14.1 has been released. It's been very exciting, I'm sure. The funny thing about 14.1, I'm running 14.0 now, and I went to the release notes just to kind of see what exactly 14.1 is going to provide me. I mean, I'm going to update, there's no question, but not right away, of course, but, I mean, eventually. So I wanted to go see what I was in for, and the kernel is, I think, 3.10.1. 7, I think. And I'm running 3.10.5 right now on my, or maybe it's 5 and I'm running 7. Either way, I'm practically getting the same kernel. And then the KDE version is 4.10.5, which is exactly the version that I'm running. Because, I mean, it's not surprising that I'm running that version, because I got it from Alien Bob, who was kind of the maintainer of the KDE stuff for Slackware. So the fact that both me and Patrick Volgreding went to him for the KDE updates really isn't surprising. It's kind of the way things work. But it is kind of amusing to me that, like, the two typical kind of benchmarks or you know, milestones of a distribution when you're looking for that new release, it's like, okay, what kernel am I getting, and what version of the desktop am I getting, and they're actually already the same. So on the surface, it will certainly be an unexciting update for me. But of course, it's the lower level library stuff that I am actually interested in. There's a couple of stuff that I feel I could go in there and update myself, but I'm not sure if I want to deal with the trouble. So having 14.1 coming out for me and having updated it all for me, I'm going to update and then update some of my user applications, and hopefully everything will work well, and I'll be back up and running in no time. So if you're not familiar with Slackware at all, if you've not used it, or if you've maybe tried it for a day and then given up, maybe you should check out 14.1. It's not going to be much different than your previous experiences, probably, but, I mean, it depends on how far back your first experience goes. Slackware, the nice thing about it is that while there might be an initial setup sort of time, after that, it just keeps going. You just run it forever until the next big release comes out. My work desktop literally would have been, the uptime would have been since 14.0 was released, hadn't it been for a major power outage on the whole block where my work is located. That took my computer down for a day, almost. So, ruined my uptime. But otherwise, it would have been Slackware 14.0, never turned off until Slackware 14.1, which is kind of cool. But alas, it was not so. But yeah, Slackware, it's great for that. I mean, if you're into distro hopping and you're into the cutting edge and all that other stuff, then avoid Slackware. It's not worth it. You don't want it. But if you're into settling down in front of your computer for a nice year-long computing session, then Slackware is really quite useful for that. And I think that for me, I mean, that's just the thing that has really enabled me to hunker down and get really serious about some of the technologies and things that I've been wanting to learn, like programmings and getting better at like 3D applications and just being able to video edit a lot more, different things like that. Well, heck, even the, like music applications, even more writing. I mean, there's just so many things that I wanted to get done that didn't involve installing and updating and reinstalling and re-updating and updating and updating and then reinstalling new Linux stuff. And it can be exciting, but it can be a big time sink too. So Slackware is kind of my step back from all of that stuff so that I can really just use the computer. And so that's what I find. That is the peace that I find in Slackware. And, you know, may you also find peace in Slackware as well. And in fact, if you try Slackware and stay with it, let me know, because I've got a really cool Bob sticker that I could send you for free if you want. Okay, so that is Slackware 14.1. If you are looking to get involved with Slack Builds, so Slack Builds is the, I like to say, unofficial, official software repository for Slackware. Slackware doesn't actually have a software repository except for the DVD that you get. That is the Slackware repository. For all the extra applications that you might want, whether it's Caden Live or QTractor or OpenOffice or LibreOffice or whatever, then you would need some other place to get Slackware packages. And that place is, or can be, slackbuilds.org. There are others. There's slacky.eu, I think, or IT. There is, there are private repositories out there, or not private, but just personal, you know, people who use Slackware who happen to have Slackware packages on their website. or build scripts on their website. And as long as they're community members that you're kind of familiar with, you could probably at least trust them enough to look at their Slack build scripts. If not, just go ahead and download their binaries. I mean, Alien Bob comes to mind. Robbie Workman comes to mind. Those people, you kind of assume that, I mean, if they have malicious intent, then we're all screwed anyway, because we're using their packages in Slackware itself. So anyway, Slack builds is kind of that place you can go for safe, secure Slackware software builds and packages sometimes. So slackbuilds.org, important. If you want to get involved with it, right now they need QA testers, because there are about 3,000 packages in the Slack builds queue that now need to be verified. Yes, this works with 14.1, both 32 and 64-bit. So join the mailing list. Look back in the archives just a couple of days for Robbie Workman's call for help. Claim some packages, test them, make sure that they work, report whether they do or do not work, and you have now contributed to Slack builds. And a lot of times I find getting involved in a project, the hardest part is that first step where you kind of need some small task to do to kind of get your name in the list as an actual contributor. So this is a perfect little, putting your foot in the door or your toe in the water, whatever you're doing. This is a great little entry-level position into sort of the Slack build community. So feel free to check that out. And, I mean, if you do that and you later become interested in building Slackware packages yourself, I mean, this is a perfect entry into that world. So slackbuilds.org, mailing list, subscribe, and look for that message from Robbie Workman about testing Slack build packages. And try Slackware. Well, it's certainly time for a cup of coffee. I know this, you know this, we're all thinking it, so go get yourself a cup of coffee, come right back, we'll finish up the show. Okay, we've had a cup of coffee, so we're ready for the big discussion. And the big discussion in this episode, again, is not terribly technical, but it is something that I figured might be interesting to discuss, to just kind of chat about. And the thing that has come to my attention lately is this whole Steam machine thing. If you've been online and if you've been looking at any number of Linux-related news stories, then you are probably aware that Valve is coming out with a console, a video game console. It's called a Steam Machine, and it runs Steam OS, which is Linux. So all of that stuff sounds very, very exciting and very, very, very appealing to any dyed-in-the-wool Linux geek. The question, I guess, is, so what? And obviously that is a big, multiple kind of angled and faceted question, because the so what for a gamer it's a big deal for a gamer. Gamers can now build their own consoles, right? Because SteamOS, from what I understand, is going to be available as, you can download the OS itself. I don't know how friendly it will be to modification and stuff like that. I mean, I'm assuming they're going to have they'll have to have source of some portion of it out there, but all of that no one cares about if you're a gamer, right? So you're a gamer, you could build your own box with, 8 different graphic cards, water-cooled, 16-core CPU, 85 gigs of RAM, whatever you want to have, you can build this mega console, put SteamOS onto it, and now you're running the gaming console of your dreams. And that's all it would be for you, right, is your gaming console. Or maybe you're more of a casual gamer and you want the ability to run Linux and only Linux, but you would also like to play those AAA game titles. So now instead of having to run, your Windows PC just for gaming and your Linux PC for work, you can now combine those two into one big PC that does both work and gaming. That's a big deal. That's a big deal, I think, for both gamers and for Linux geeks, because that's a valid, I mean, that's a valid complaint against gaming companies in general. Why are you making games only for, well, really for serious gaming? It was only for Windows. I mean, you couldn't be a real gamer and be running anything but Windows if you want to do PC gaming. Don't argue with me on that. I know that. I mean, and people, I think, I mean, certainly there's, you know, there are Linux gamers who just say, okay, this is my Linux PC, and now I'm going to be a console gamer for the gaming stuff. But that's silly to make people choose between, you know, you can have a console or a PC, but if you want not to run Windows, it has to be a console. That's just silly. Okay, so I think for gamers and for Linux gamers, this is a big deal. I think it's a great thing that Valve is going over to Linux for many, many reasons. It certainly, it I wanted, I think I feel like I want to say it validates Linux in the eyes of somebody, but it doesn't really validate Linux. It simply says it simply dis you know unvalidates to some degree Windows as a development platform. I don't think that honestly this is going to change anyone's view towards Linux or Windows. I think if people are very invested in Windows programming, they don't care about an open, flexible environment. That's not what they need, obviously, because they're perfectly fine in that little tiny, by which I mean huge, ecosystem that is, you know, everything that Microsoft makes their programming environment encompass. As long as you play it by their rules, you're very, very happy. And that's the same with any other environment, except Linux, where you can do whatever the heck you want. So, I don't think people are going to look at this and say, oh, wow, Valve is going to Linux. I'm going to abandon everything I know about Windows and switch over to Linux full-time. What I do think it does is it opens up a big, you know, potential door for Linux programmers now, because now they can keep their Linux knowledge and go, you know, potentially work for companies porting Linux games, writing Linux code, doing things, you know, that actually make money for a very, very big company like Valve, which is very exciting, and I think that's a great, great thing. I think more Linux jobs out there are basically a great thing. That's very, very good. And I guess in some way that kind of validates Linux in like education and stuff like that. I mean, you can now always point to Valve and say, look, if you want to learn this stuff and you want to work for Valve, you ought to know Linux. Simple. What I think it's also going to do is, or has already done, it's going to improve video drivers and video performance for Linux, which I don't think that we are going to feel on an everyday user level for the most part. I think we'd feel it if we were gamers. Maybe you are a gamer, maybe you will feel it. For me, myself, I've been doing video and 3D stuff on Nouveau drivers lately. My first iteration of this workstation had 13.37, Slackware 13.37, and I was running the NVIDIA drivers because honestly, it just wasn't working without. 14.0 came out. Nouveau drivers have I just forgot. It just slipped my mind to even bother installing the NVIDIA drivers. It just wasn't necessary. And one day I realized I'd never done that. But I'd been using Blender and Kdenlive and all these other applications and never ran into a video related issue whatsoever. So I don't think I'm going to see it. If you're a gamer and you want maximum frames per second and maximum quality settings, maybe that'll be where you really see the difference. Either way, I think it's cool that a big industry or big industries like NVIDIA are now having to cater even more to Linux. And that's what it takes, unfortunately, for these big companies. It simply takes serious monetary incentive. And I've seen this in practice. I used to work for a company that was developing some programs, and they, I mean, they would literally call up, and I'm assuming pay NVIDIA to send someone out to their office to do their secret firmware updates on the card and to make it match what the proprietary code needed it to do. And it was debugging straight from Valve. It was a house call. And not Valve, NVIDIA. It was a house call. So it seems like, unfortunately, that's what they needed. And now Valve is that company calling NVIDIA up saying, "Hey, we need better frame rates on this. We need, I don't know, better escape, see, the word's escaping me. Triangular, they're triangles, they're prisms, whatever. We need better performance." NVIDIA comes out, flips some bits, and gets paid, and now suddenly it works better. I'm not saying they're doing it intentionally not to make it work better, but they're not going to the trouble of making it work better because no one's calling them with money to tell them, "You need to come fix this." Now Valve is calling them and saying, "You need to fix this," and by gum, it's being fixed. And you know what else is being fixed? And this is just, I find this uncanny. Previously, gaming companies kept saying, and heck, even other companies other than gaming companies, they've been saying, "Oh, it's too hard to maintain Linux code bases. It's just too much variation, and it's too cha- it, you know, too many different libraries," and all of these excuses about why they couldn't just develop a Linux version, right? And I mean, heck, we could even take Adobe as an example. They for some reason just can't be bothered to make Linux versions of whatever software. Not that I care. I'm just using them as an example because I honestly do not care. I'm actually quite happy without them. But other people, I guess, wouldn't be. So my point is that these companies keep using this excuse, Linux just, we can't do it, it's too hard, not enough Linux, whatever. Suddenly, now that Valve is using SteamOS, which is Linux, these major AAA game titles are suddenly Linux-sized within a month or two. I mean, I've seen, what is it, Metro Last Light? That just came out, relatively just came out. It just came out, and now suddenly that Valve says, "Okay, we're going to Linux." Suddenly, within, I guess, 2 months of Steam's, of Valve's announcement, suddenly we have Metro Last Light on Linux. There are lots of other examples. Metro is just the one that I saw most recently, and that's the one. Well, Left 4 Dead, that's another one. But that, I think that's Valve anyway. So anyway, point is, certain games out there are suddenly coming out with Linux versions within a couple of months of the Steam announcement, and you're just thinking, well, gee, I guess it wasn't so hard after all, was it? I mean, we were told that porting stuff to Linux was just so difficult and just took so many man-hours and would never get done and just wasn't important enough. And suddenly Valve mentions, "Okay, we're going to be running Linux on the back end," and suddenly it's not really that hard. We'll pump out a Linux version just really quickly here. So I think that's a nice little demonstration of how frequently we're just given total and utter lies as computer users, as news readers, and it's a little bit disappointing. And I think I even wrote a blog about this once. There was something about, like, not that specifically, but something related, about like how games and how different technologies could be using much more generic, platform agnostic technology, and they just don't. And there's no good reason for it, and they come up with reasons, and they say, "Well, the performance of such and such just isn't up to speed of the performance of this proprietary one." And it's just a bunch of nonsense. It's lies, and if you know a little bit about building up a system and performance and getting things to work together, you just know it's a lie. And I don't know why the lies are perpetuated. I don't know the goal, but they just won't. They won't do it because they don't want to. It's not because they can't. So I think this SteamOS thing is kind of a really good example of that sort of bearing out. That it's very true that these companies could be a lot more Linux friendly, they could be a lot more platform agnostic, they could be writing cross-compatible, multi-platform code. They just don't. And it's stupid. I mean, I can see the argument for, Apple or Microsoft to keep a vendor lock-in because they're the big vendors, right? But places like Adobe, I mean, who cares if you're writing it for Windows, for Apple, or for Linux? It doesn't really matter. You don't need to lock in anyone to a vendor. So I'm assuming there's some kind. I mean, you are the vendor. Adobe is the vendor. I'm assuming there's got to be backroom deals going on where Adobe is just like, well, we don't want to offend this vendor by catering to this other vendor over here. So I'm kind of assuming, or the people are just too clueless to get the idea that yes, we could actually be platform agnostic. And to a lot of people in the computing industry, platform agnosticism is not a big deal. It's not what they're interested in. It's not an important topic to them. They don't care. If you have to buy a computer with an expensive OS and have to maintain that OS, that's just your problem. It's not theirs. They're not going to make anything easier on you because you're just a customer. So I don't know. Those are my thoughts inspired by the Steam Machine. Is the Steam Machine exciting? Yeah, I think it's really exciting, honestly. Not really for Linux and open source. I don't think it's going to actually do that much for either of those two things, but it's just kind of nice to see the gaming industry diversify a little bit and give the consumer a little bit more of an option in what they use for their gaming habit. So that's exciting, and I'm glad that Valve has made that decision, but I wouldn't make the mistake if I were you of befriending Valve. I wouldn't like them on Facebook or friend them on whatever. Just, they're a company. They didn't do it because they're your friend. They're just doing it because it makes sense for them. So don't make this into something that it's not. It's just they happen to use the same back-end technology that you use for your desktop. It doesn't make them your best buddy. Keep that in mind. I think it's a common mistake that many of us make to try to, you know, suddenly buddy up with companies like they're pals, and they would never betray us because they're our pal. Well, they're not our pal. They're just a big company. But it is nice. It's nice to see them using Linux. It's nice to see that Linux, some technology that Linux uses is going to be advanced in a Linux-friendly way. And hopefully, I don't know, hopefully it'll take off. Hopefully it'll be a big deal. Okay, I wanted to mention two more things, and then we'll end the show. So one is kind of another distro review, which I don't know if I've actually done that many right now, but anyway, a distro review would be PearOS, P-E-A-R-O-S. It doesn't happen often, but I get the feeling that it's going to start happening more often, that a Mac user is actually going to want to switch over to Linux. PearOS is that operating system, or is that distro, that makes that transition a little bit easier. PearOS blatantly rips off the user interface, the look and the feel, the behavior of the Mac desktop. And as always, anytime a Linux distribution is trying to mimic one of the proprietary OSs, you can always find the places where it fails miserably. You know, there's always like those little things that you're like, that would never happen on this platform. And that's just because they're not really emulating it. They're taking existing technology, existing ways of doing things, and just changing them a little bit so that it acts a little bit more like that desktop environment, and it looks a little bit more like it. So it's a very, very thinly veiled kind of mimicry. However, that said, PearOS, since about version 5 or so, has been doing a really, really good job. I'll admit that I'm not the most discerning Mac user at this point. I mean, my Mac usage is down to, you know, I mean, it's at work only, and it's maintaining, you know, debugging, trying to fix problems on Mac systems. I maybe once a week at the most. I mean, it's really, really low at this point. So my bias has really reduced itself to sort of nothing anymore. Now, if you show me something with a dock and with the window buttons on the left instead of the right, I'm like, yeah, that's Mac-like. It's totally, you got it, you nailed it. It's exactly like a Mac. Okay, I might not be that bad, but I'm pretty close to it. I'm really well invested now at this point in the Linux kind of desktops and the way that they behave. So I've actually found, you know, the reverse has become true. I sit down at a proprietary computer, and suddenly everything annoys me, and it's stupid, and it's backwards, and I don't understand how it's supposed to work. So yeah, I've made that. I've I've gone through that transition, that transformation. I'm now spoiled. I'm no good. But I do have a friend who still uses Mac sometimes, uses Linux other times. They're using Pear OS, and it's honestly it was the breaking point. It was that has been the distribution that has really enabled them to go over to Linux. It's changed that 60-40 so that the 60 is Linux and 40 is Mac rather than the other way around. So I've been really impressed with it, and I've kind of kept an eye on it just because it seems to be the one Mac-like distro that has kind of kept going and has been doing things very smartly and seriously. Because there's always that, there's always a distro out there like, hey, we look like a Mac, and there was Dream Linux for a while. There was something else, and there were some plugins or like some scripts that you could run to retheme GNOME or something. None of it ever worked. Pear OS is really, really it goes that extra mile. I mean, there are a lot of things in it that are very, very close to what it would be like on a Mac. And I think it's doubly interesting because I see now in the latest Mac releases that Apple is starting to borrow from GNOME 3 and rather than, GNOME 2 borrowing from Mac, which is, I feel, a little bit like it was before. So it's interesting in that sense too. It's almost becoming easier to look like Mac because Mac is starting to rip off ideas from Linux. And I know that, I mean, desktops borrow ideas from each other all the time, so I don't say that spitefully at all. I'm just saying it's becoming easier for one to adapt to be like the other. So if you have friends who are, interested in Linux but are used to the Mac, or if you have friends who are too dumb to know that Linux and Mac aren't the same thing, throw Pear OS on a computer for them. It's really, really nice. I just threw it onto a Toshiba that a friend of mine brought to me for repair. I partitioned it, put her old OS on one half, like Windows something or another, and then put Pear OS on another partition, and that's going to be her fallback partition. And the advantage there is that it looks and feels like a Mac, so it's going to look cool and different to her. So lots of uses for it. Again, no copycat of any proprietary thing is ever going to win anyone over. It's just on the surface. There's still going to be differences. They're still not going to have access to Adobe whatever. They're not going to have Microsoft Office. All the problems are still going to be there. I'm just saying that in terms of looking and feeling like a Mac, Pear OS definitely does a really, really good job. It's Ubuntu based, so it's easy to maintain for even, the dumb users. So yeah, there's a lot going for it. You should check it out if you're needing something to fill that niche. Pear OS is the place to go, and that's pearos.fr. It's in France. And last but not least, I might have mentioned this before, but I wanted to mention it again. I did a website called, well, not called, geared toward introducing people to Slacks. Slacks, of course, I've talked about. I think I talked about it for like 2 hours straight in the season closer for season 8. If people are interested in Slacks, you want them to try it out, or you're interested in Slacks and have never used it, this Slacks site that I did is just, it's a nice little getting started guide. Not a lot of words, it's a lot of pictures. It's on straightedgelinux.com/slacks. Or if you just go to straightedgelinux.com, you'll see the button for it right there on the front page on the right. And it will take you through Slacks one step at a time. I mean, it'll take you through installing, it'll take you through most of the major applications like the desktop, how to set your network stuff, your sound settings, what application you should use to manage files, what application you should use to browse the web, all this kind of obvious to you and me, but not so obvious to new users who are afraid of this new strange thing called Linux. So it goes through all that stuff in lots and lots of pictures, not that many words. It's specifically designed, that all the words that are present only support the pictures. So it's very, very visual. And then the last section of the site is troubleshooting, so if they have problems, they can go to the troubleshooting and hopefully figure some things out. Slacks is still fantastic. It's been absolutely changing the way that I've been able to use Linux in the classroom, and even in my real life. I mean, I always have Slacks on my keychain. It's always there, so I can go to any computer and use Linux. So it's really great. And recently, the computing platform that I have really the greatest access to has finally enabled booting from USB, so now I can even do it locally here at work. So it's really, really nice. I encourage people on this Slacks site to just buy the thing. There's a thumb drive and there are CDs from osdisk.com, which you've probably seen ads for if you've ever been to DistroWatch. The CDs, I think, the bootable CDs are like $3. The thumb drive is $25. And I feel like, and this is working theory, I'm not sold on this yet, but I feel like sometimes selling Linux to people and always selling it as free, I mean, you're selling it to them as free, but you're also selling it to them, unbeknownst to them, it's going to take work. You can download it for free, isn't that great? Oh, and now you have to learn what a partition is, and how to partition a drive, and how not to erase data, and how to get the thing to be bootable, and all these other things that people just freak out about. I mean, there are the easiest installs out there ever for operating systems, and people still can't get through them. So throw something like Linux at them, and it's too much. Too much. So if they buy a CD or a computer or a thumb drive with Linux already on it, that's such a big deal. So I encourage people to just pay for it. That's the first step in the website. I mean, I go through the other steps, like not buying it and getting it onto a thumb drive or a CD, how to properly do that. But I do start out with the assumption that, hey, if you want to try this thing, put down some money and try it. And just get over that first initial learning curve of, oh my gosh, I have to figure out how to get this onto a thumb drive and make that thumb drive bootable and that, do all these different things. So that's a working theory that I have, that, you know, getting people to install Linux is harder than getting people to buy Linux. I could be wrong about that. And I know a lot of Linux users want to learn the installing stuff. I mean, if you just handed me a Linux computer back in the day, I might not have been as interested. I mean, I would have been, but I would have reinstalled. I mean, it's something, you know, I've been installing operating systems my entire life, so not knowing how to install it, and not knowing how to get a flexible install done, just would not have worked for me. So I know a lot of Linux users don't worry about that, but I think some do. And so remembering that there are options out there, like osdisk.com, and no, I don't have a deal with osdisk.com, I'm just saying, they exist. And Slacks.org itself is selling thumb drives with Slacks preloaded. I mean, there's just so many reasons not to make people install Linux, you know? Just get them to buy it and boot into it. That's a good first step for anyone. So that's just, I don't know, you can think about that. You can argue the point, but that's my current working theory. So Slacks, yeah, try it out if you haven't tried it, or if you're curious, or if you want to see screenshots, whatever, straightedgelinux.com/slacks. I'm using it as a tool because when I'm promoting some of my lesson plans and things like that for programming classes that I've been teaching lately, the thing that I use as our environment is Slacks, a bootable disk of Slacks with all the programming tools that people need on it. And so having a website that they can go to and look at and review and kind of get familiar with this environment in a very friendly, picture-heavy, word-light way has been a very good tool. So feel free to use it if you need that in your life. StraightEdgeLinux.com/slacks. That is it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
I hope Mr. Morgan's brain is as cooperative.
It will be, Charles.